Chairperson, the very first one from the Chairperson, we are not suggesting that SAFT is not doing its work when it comes to SAFT. I think it is quite very clear that their responsibility in regard to that is confined to the Consumer and Control Act and the name that they license, although it also talks about the categories of what they can license, what they should not license, but they say there is currently a very huge gap in terms of the use, in particular in the private security industry. So we are complementing that. In developing those type of regulations, we are going to be working with SAFT, we are going to be working with all other stakeholders, so it's not, I think it's good. The regulations will be to complement what is already in the Firearms Control Act. Chairperson, with regard to the investigations, you will notice that CIRA has investigative powers already in the Act, but these investigative powers are confined only to this in respect of the private security industry space. You will also notice that we have all law enforcement powers when it comes to searches, arrests, with or without warrants, including the use of lethal force. Ordinarily, under normal circumstances, we should have our own enforcement team, which is armed. And that we've been trying to, in fact, that has been in the planning for quite a long time. The reason we haven't implemented that fully, it is because of issues of funds and so on, Chairperson. But we do make arrests. Most of the cases, we do the arrests ourselves. And we work primarily with SAFT because certain incidents are quite very dangerous, where people are armed and so on, so we go with SAFT. But we do have investigative powers, but we're also quite aware of the limit in terms of the investigation that we have. As I said earlier, they investigate criminal offenses that are ordinarily investigated, but it is like your murder, like your assault and attempted murder and so on. Our investigation has to do with all criminal offenses that are committed in respect of the Private Security Industry Regulatory Act. So that's our limit. And even the Act says that. It says that you can only exercise these powers in relation to the national service, but in respect of the private security industry. So that there is that kind of distinction that we make. My colleague will speak about the issue of uniform. There is something that we are doing about it. The firearms regulation, I think Honorable Kolabanat, I have partly answered the question. The intention here is not to forbid the issue of firearms, and as Stefan will give a context completely. And as I said, we will work with parties. In fact, we have already had a meeting with Professor Bauer from the University of South Africa, Universities of South Africa, I think it's the association, he's the CEO of that body, in regard to how we're going to work with the universities to develop guidelines in which we will later take into the regulations of how do we then deal with the issue of firearms equipment and security equipment in university space, for instance. So that will be translating into that. So I don't think that the intention would be to bar firearms completely. There was also a question about the clean audit. Chairperson, we are still on course to get a clean audit. You will notice that in that previous year, before the last, we had four findings away from it. Then we came two findings, so we're still on course. Even this year, we will try to get there. And I think it's a matter of us getting enough controls, providing the assurance to the AG and ultimately to members of the public. I think we've done very well, Chairperson. We're still trying. We're improving. If you look at all our audit outcomes, we're improving almost every day. There are challenges there and there, but we are working very hard to get. The first one is to get the clean audit. We will not rest until we do that. Chairperson, the context around the issue of ESHO, I've mentioned that we have not investigated it. We are onto it, our investigators are onto it. And I also want to mention that we are not looking into issues of racism there. I have heard the honorable member talking about a black farmer, a black security officer. I'm not aware of any allegations of racism, so we're not investigating that at all. We are also not investigating the criminal charges regarding the assault and so on. We are investigating the conduct again. And we are not saying that we do not investigate criminal cases, but we do investigate those specific criminal investigations that are related to the act, the contravention. We do partly investigate also some of those that need to be handed over to the police. For instance, if we investigate a charge of abuse of power, and we realize that this is no longer abuse of power, it's in fact assault, we will hand over this investigation to the police. So our members are well trained, they are able to take affidavits, they are able to open dockets. Most of them, in the majority of our inspectors, are former police officers, so they know how to maneuver within the terrain. Let me hand over to my colleague to deal with the issue of protest.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll just go back to the issue of the uniforms and the concern raised, and I think we've mentioned this before, that it's one of our concerns as well. In terms of our strategic plan for the current financial year, we've identified two topics that needs to have regulations, and that was the uniforms and working animals in the private security industry. Those regulations is in draft form. They are already done. Research has been completed on them. We will be sending those draft regulations to the Minister of Police by the end of this month for publication in for comment in Government Gazette. So those are our priority regulations that we've identified for this current financial year, and the issue of the uniforms and the resemblance and the camouflage and those things that we've highlighted before are being addressed in those regulations. The added issue was the proposal in terms of the firearm regulations. I think the director spoke about it, it won't clash with the current regulatory framework. But what we are saying from our side is when the firearms are used in the security industry, we want to set up standards as far as that is concerned. We don't want to prevent businesses from having firearms. We know there's a need for security businesses in the asset and transit industry. You know, their lives are at risk as well. There must be, you know, a room for that as well. But, you know, certain areas, you know, we want to close some of the gaps that's currently there, where, as I explained, the business applies for a LN, or a semi-automatic rifle, because they argue they're going to be doing asset and transit, but then the firearm is used, you know, at the shopping mall for normal security duties. Those kind of things we want to deal with. One of the questions in terms of suspension also one of the questions raises, is it practice that we suspend registrations, and are we not prejudging the outcome of a criminal investigation or a proper conduct charged by CIRA? Now, I won't say we're prejudging it. Our act empowers us. If there's prima facie evidence of improper conduct or criminal conduct, then we can suspend. What we do is, and we follow fair administrative procedures as well. It's not a one-sided decision that we as regulator takes. We will notify the person or the business of our intention to suspend and why we intend to suspend. And we will allow the person to give an opportunity to submit replications. And there's a committee that we appoint, so our regulatory subcommittee, that will then evaluate what was submitted to us. And then an informed decision is taken. But as I mentioned, it's prima facie evidence. It's quite clear. You know, and we obviously consider things like the risk posed to the public and all those kind of things before we take a decision on suspension. It's not something I can promise the committee that we take lightly. We don't suspend nilly-willy registrations and remove people from having their businesses and gaining employment as far as that is concerned. The issue of the universities, it is a complicated matter. I think I want just to put into context, our directive and the standards that we set there wasn't decided overnight. We saw it when the Fees Must Fall campaign started, that there was significant challenges with the conduct of the security industry. We then raised it with NatJoc and NatJoints, that, you know, where does the role of SOPs step in and public order policing, and where does the role of private security intersect? There's definitely a role for both. We recognize that as well. But I think the challenge that we experience in that environment is there's almost no distinction between the two roles. Private security industry is fulfilling the function of POPs. Now, we know in terms of the Gatherings Act, and we know in terms of the standard operating procedure that was issued in 2014, that the role of the SAPS when it comes to crowd control is directly the responsibility of trained police officers that's associated with the public order police. And to allow a security officer to fulfill exactly that same function with a one-week training curriculum and a grade course is injustice to that security officer. I think, you know, the purpose of our aim wasn't to be punitive in the end of the day, but we also looked at the interest of not just the students, but of the security officers themselves there that are required to render the service, but they are not equipped and they are not trained to do it. Of course, this is a specialized service that's given to a specialized police officer as well through public order police training. So that is the kind of thing that we try to address through the directive. Now, we do appreciate the concerns raised that, you know, whether our directive is tying the hands of the client, the consumer, in the end of the day. We've heard in the UCT that the biohazard, you know, in a research facility, and our students access that laboratories, they actually claimed in the Western Cape needs to evacuate. You know, so what does the university do in an environment where a biohazard waste can be exposed to the general public and the public order police, for argument's sake, is not there, and it's only the security officers? So those kind of things are obviously concerns, and I think you correctly pointed out as well the safety risk to the security officers themselves. But our directive tries to address this issue and saying, but if there's significant risk to the security officer, and this function is exclusively, in terms of the Gatherings Act, that responsibility of the public order police, then surely the security officer should not be placed in that position in the first place. And that is what we try to address with the director. I must say, Chairperson, we've received a legal challenge on the director. We intend to withdraw the directive in its current form and then look at a regulation that deals with that. We obviously take note of the concerns raised by the director. But as I mentioned, this is not something that emanated from us overnight. You know, this is something that's a dual document between us and public order police, and that we issued for the safety not only of students, but also the safety of the security officers that are asked to put their lives at risk to protect the property of clients. The issue of the platform where communities can raise conduct, I think, and I mentioned it, Chairperson, we're very much involved with campaigns in terms of for the public in general to understand the role of CIRA. We do have, for instance, health tests, we have complaint tests, and the director also mentioned of our desk, where complaints are reported through a KPMG hotline. So those, you know, platforms are there. It's whether everyone knows about that platform. So I think that is something that we also can address.
Now, Chairperson, we've also been very aggressive on the social media space, especially on Twitter as well as on Facebook, WhatsApp, so we're available on all those platforms. And some of our complaints we're investigating emanate from that source as well.
Thank you, Chairperson. The issue of, and I think one concern was raised on this in-house and almost a militarization of some of the security companies in terms of the equipment that they have. Now, there are structures within government that looks at that, and we've actually met with them as well, and we intend to establish a more formal memorandum of agreement on the type of equipment that the security companies can purchase. But part of our regulations that we spoke about, when we talk about the development of firearm regulations, it won't be restricted just to firearm regulations. We'll also talk to equipment. Because there need to be some form of control over some of the equipment that the security industry is in fact acquiring. So those regulations will be addressing that as well.
Chair, just on the same issue, I think it's important also to make the committee aware that the other military kind of look like equipments, the security companies would go to the conventional weapons committee and apply for those. So that's the gap that we're trying to bridge, because we were not aware. They will go to those committees and apply for to buy armored vehicles, for instance, all sorts of paramilitary kind of equipment. So we've established the link. We will be talking to them and see whether we can build in guidelines in terms of controlling that area as well. Because these things are no longer going to the military space, they're coming into the civilian space, which is where the problem is.
Thank you, Chairperson. The other question was, who do we charge? Or who do we suspend, if there's an improper conduct investigation? It depends on who's being charged. If an individual, a case is against a particular individual and that person committed improper conduct, we may suspend the registration of that particular individual. If there's a criminal investigation for a scheduled offence, it will be directed to a particular individual or particular company. So we consider the suspension of whoever committed the improper conduct or whoever committed the criminal case. So if we intend to charge a business for employing unregistered security officers, then we can send a letter of intent to suspend the business for contravening the code of conduct. But if we, for instance, like in some of these investigations we've done, like the close protection officers in the vehicle that cocked their firearms, that's obviously conduct of the security officers themselves. The business had no instructions that they should do that, then we move to the suspension of those particular individuals.
The aspect about when we charge them, where do we call them to with their SMSs? We call them to Acadia, and some of them come to Centurion, and mainly we service the directors in Centurion. Chairperson, maybe let me also take this opportunity to give an update. You will recall that we've been trying to address the issue of Acadia for many years, beginning with the trying to procure alternative spaces for Acadia. We eventually have appointed a service provider to provide us with alternative space. They are busy with configuring that space for their purpose, and they should be able to hand over to us at the end of April, beginning of May. Unfortunately, the original service provider could not even provide us with a project plan, and ultimately we realized it doesn't have the capability to do the project, so we terminated and appointed the second best one, which will be delivering now in April. So there will be some finality about Acadia. We are quite aware of the injustice that we're doing to security officers that are having to go and queue there, in particular now that we have long queues trying to address the issues of certificates. Chairperson, I think the issue about UJ, we had investigated that matter, Chairperson. We were able to determine that the person who actually discharged the firearm as a security officer, we were able to also determine the identity of the companies that were involved. We did take action, and we have withdrawn the registration of the company that was subcontracted to the main company we would like to do. So they're no longer trading as we speak, unless if they're trading somewhere it would be legal. So we took away their license to trade. Chairperson, the issue about security officers, the Honourable Maki asked about what do we do with those situations where schools hire old people to look after schools and so on, because they're trying to also partly assist them with employment as well as looking after the school. Chairperson, the reason we have taken the decision to charge the Department of Education as well as the Department of Community Safety was for a number of years now, more than 4 years, or 5 years if I'm sure to be correct, we've been running campaigns in specifically with regard to State Department, how they should comply, and that the CIRA Act is actually binding to the state. I serve on one of the structures, in particular the structure called the National Security Managers Forum, which is chaired by SSA. In that forum, we have all the security managers in government, from province, national, as well as state entities, where we talk to them about compliance. So these issues are quite very clear to them. So the issue of old people being used in schools, we've raised it before with them, and we've made it very clear that we will not allow them, under whatever circumstances, to utilize people who are not vetted. We don't have any problem with them being used. We say, let's vet these people. So sometimes you take an old person who necessarily was not in the employment but has been sitting in jail all his life, and he comes back now, he's retired from jail, and you want to use him in a school where he's going to look after children, without actually looking at what he was doing in jail. So we are quite very strict in those environments. So that's how we deal with that situation.
Sorry, Director, just a follow-up on that issue. Thank you.
When you do your vetting, specifically of security personnel at schools, etc., do you check with the sexual offences register?
We do check that if it is we are informed. I just want to bring this context. Why is that? Remember that the primary vetting that is done by the school itself, right? And we do the criminal record aspect of it. So if we do our searches and we come to the attention of information that the person is involved or was involved in other things, we do take action. We've done so on a number of times with incidents where we block people from registering because we there are media cases of them having been involved in ulterior matters and so on.
Thank you, Chairperson. As the director was answering, I was thinking of a situation where it's a corner shop, normal school, where we can say the department that would be responsible. If it's a corner shop and the same situation applies, the owner gets somebody who's unemployed to look after his shop, does it apply the minimum wage and every other thing, or is it just an arrangement between the two of them?
Thank you. Director.
Chairperson, the minimum wages are supposed to apply. You have to recall that we also regulate in-house security services. So we might not require the company itself or the owner to apply to us to register to us because he's not doing it for commercial purposes, but he still needs to comply with all other legislations with regard to the payment of wages and so on. The issue about nightclubs, whether we do close the white nightclubs after we've dealt with the security company or if we don't. That unfortunately is not in our domain. It's the Department of Trade and Industry, and specifically the issue of liquor boards. They're the ones who are licensed in these nightclubs. So if we remove a security company, nightclub will still be open. They will simply get another security company that's complying and just carry on with the trade.
It's
I'm not sure if there's anything that's
Thank you, Chairperson. I wanted to ask the committee members that in your capacity as committee member, for the issue of the safety in schools needs to be really re-looked with a different eye. The Department of Basic Education has spent a lot of resources and time setting guidelines for safety in schools. If you go to their website, you can see they've done a lot of poking around the issue of safety in schools. But if you look at what they look at the issues of access to drugs, how that can be prevented, they look at issues of infrastructure protection, and after that they link with it to the local police station. But they are very silent around the issue of how they engage with the people who are guards at school. And people in education, they'll tell you that there are more than 24,000 public schools in this country. And that's why you find that most of these kids are vulnerable. I think the cases that we cited in Soweto and Mamelodi probably are just a tip of the iceberg of the challenges faced by public schools when it comes to issues of food, contrast with the reality of our guards and their schools, as Honorable Mark has raised. And this hit me last week when I visited Buhlange High School in KZN, when I found that the secret guard, Buhlange is a whole school with history. But even a person whom they've contracted at the gate, it's a person you can see was half drunk, and this was about 11 o'clock in the morning, you know, got no clue what Sira is going to ask him whether there is sugar. You know, so I think these are issues which probably the Committee on Basic Education is being taken head on by this committee in terms of whether they do understand around the issue of regulation of private security in the public schools. Because these are our public entities, and definitely we might be having different acts where people are not even aware that they need to be engaging with the Sirahat. I just wanted to raise that one as a concern to the community.
It's just interesting to me that right now as we're speaking, the reason my colleague is not here, Zakhele, is in Pretoria launching a school safety campaign, because safety of our learners, I suppose we call them now, it's a huge issue. I mean, I cannot bear to hear another story about pupils being gang raped by principals and teachers, and one tends to hear of these sexual assaults in the schools or sex for marks, and then somehow the cases just evaporate in the wind, and 5 years down the line you find the same teachers are there and the pupils have moved on and they're still doing what they shouldn't be doing. So I absolutely agree with you. The protection of our youngsters is paramount. And you know, you have children snatched in Amlazi. We searched for days for a young girl and her body was found actually on the school grounds, but it was so overgrown because it had never been cut. It was like a forest, and they finally found her there. So there are dangers to around schools, and for our youngsters walking to and from school, and even now you think when they get inside the school grounds they're safe, but I fear they're not.
No, thank you. I think we take note of it. Of course, from a policy point of view, we'll raise it. But once again, it also relates to the role of governing bodies of schools. That should be the first stop. Governing bodies of schools should give leadership. They should ensure that their policy framework is in place to ensure the safety of children. That's the starting point. Of course, the police is a multiplier and must do their job. But you know, from our perspective, we'll raise it to the relevant committee. But we believe governing bodies, they should really own that space and ensure that our schools are safe. Okay, let's go to Officer Donald.
Thank you, Chair. There was a question as well whether when do we determine non-compliance? When it's reported to us or when? In terms of our strategy and our law enforcement strategy, we've got a compliance and an enforcement unit. So we've got a proactive and a reactive side of doing verifications. Our compliance unit is basically going out door to door, visit to business, and conduct inspections at security office being deployed. And there we do verifications whether they are legally registered or not. So we do report on that as well in our annual report. We do in the region about 32,000 proactive inspections at security offices per year, and that can obviously also trigger further investigations if we found non-compliance. And then we've got an enforcement unit that deals with the reactive side of it, where complaints is locked, that the business is employing unregistered security officers, where they will then do these investigations, as I reported in my presentation. Question was also asked, whether we suspended the business that was involved in Tolton, or just the owner of the company, and that is the particular example where we only suspended the registration of the individual, of the person that's been charged, not that of the business. And then lastly, just to give input on the issue of payment of security officers. Although the labour legislation deals with minimum wages for particular categories, that in-house person
will definitely be affected by the National Minimum Wage Act that intends to come into operation on the 1st of May. So there will be, you know, implications for the employer in terms of employing that individual. I think the minimum wage will be 20 rand per hour, and that will be the statutory minimum wage for everyone that's not regulated by a specific sectoral determination for the industry. For things there.
Thank you very much. I think that is all. Any other responses to your question? Mm-hmm. Right, let's go to the members for the final round on the procedure.
Yeah, no, thank you, Chairperson. I'm just bothered about people who keep on talking about civil law being so bold in front of people. So how are you ensuring as management that this industry does not behave in a way that it threatens the democratic state? Because there are lots of security companies with a lot of these firearms, etc. So how do you monitor or ascertain that they will not turn against the state? Because there are so many, with so many firearms, etc.
Alright, other members? Maybe just two from my side, maybe if the director can just keep this a little short overview. I think we raised it previously. What is the issue of the big players in South Africa in the security industry, the foreign ownership in South Africa, ownership, the relation, if there are any changes that we just know? And then also in terms of cooperation and liaison with the SADC countries, because the important issue is that is there any progress with regard to that, similar standards, similar procedures, is there anything happening in that space? Sorry, thank you, Mr. Sadak. On a normal basis.
Thank you, Chairperson. You see, the issue of, I'm not being xenophobic, the issue of foreign nationals keeps on coming when there are some misconduct that took place or some crime that took place. How do you ensure that this does not happen in the future?
Thank you. Members, that's the questions. Thank you very much. Let's go then to Sira for the final responses. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. There was a question about how do we monitor the issue of people who are making threats about the civil war and so on, taking into account that the private security industry is armed. Chairperson, let me say that, as I've mentioned, we play in quite a lot of roles in the private security industry. We've made mention of the Stability Committee at national level. We've made mention of the Ned Jones, Claude Jones, and so on. But most importantly, we also play at the counterintelligence organization forum. You might not know about it because it is not a forum that is out there. It is actually a body that is more powerful than actually NICOP itself. In that forum, we look around the issues of this. That's where we get to look at issues of national intelligence estimates, about threats of this nature and so on. So, but I think there is adequate monitoring of it. But as well, we have platforms where when issues like this are raised, for instance, when there is a strike that's going to happen, basically, so I get to know about it even much earlier than ordinary people know about it, just by it circulating in the social media. So there is adequate, you know. I'm not sure about what we're doing about it on the control side, because as I always mentioned, Chairperson, the Firearms Control Act was meant to control the proliferation of firearms. So that is another aspect that we need to be looking at as well, to control from that point of view. But there is adequate monitoring of these structures from where we are sitting. Chairperson, the
change about the ownership in patterns in the private security industry. There is a lot that happened in the past 3-4 years. There has been the big transactions happening. For instance, ADT has been bought by Fidelity. As you might know, ADT was one of the largest alarm and response company in South Africa. It has been bought by Fidelity. Recently, CHAP has been bought by National Security, which is a local company. I'm not sure there's a foreign content in there. You know, CHAP was a foreign company. Securitas is a foreign company, but it's almost half owned by South Africans. So I'm quite aware that G4S, for instance, was also looking at selling its South African stake or African stake to locals, and I'm quite aware that there's been an interest in some of that progress. Service is currently owned in majority by black South Africans. KTH, the Kaiser Trust Holdings, is owning Service Africa. So there's a lot of movement that happened to a point where I think one can say that most of the big companies that used to be foreign owned from Zululand are now either partly South African owned or locally owned in majority. So that movement continues to happen in Jefferson.
So thank you, Honourable Molobasi. Follow up.
Thank you, Chair. Are you able to verify the funding aspect?
Chairperson, unfortunately not. But remember that our legislation is crafted in such a way that we are able to control those operations. So if you're a director, for instance, of a debt company, you cannot be a foreign national unless you comply with all the requirements. So we are able to control that aspect. But in regard to shareholdership, unfortunately not. In particular, when companies are listed as JSE, we don't know who's behind the money part of it. That's something that we need to be looking at. I think the current legislation that is before the president was trying to address that aspect in regard to the ownership and how we can actually look into those kind of controls, Chair. Chair, you've also asked the question, how far are we in terms of looking at the SADC area? Chairperson, unfortunately, there hasn't been a lot with regard to that aspect. You will notice that two years ago, we launched a Pan-African Forum where we actually invited quite a lot of our Pan-African colleagues, SADC colleagues, as well as, up in the north as well. We also did a research specifically around SADC. We published a book on it. I think part of the reason why we have not looked so much at the issue of funds with the prioritization, but we are still talking to these colleagues, very close to them, and we are still collaborating in other fronts as well. We will be taking this matter forward, because ultimately we want to share actually the expertise around each other in terms of formalizing and regulation. Indeed, there's a number of countries that have shown interest. Last year we hosted the Botswana. We also have received interest from Uganda. We've received interest from Swaziland. We've received, but some of them have not been forthcoming. This year I think we've just received an invite also to benchmark from Brazil. So somewhere down the third quarter of the year we'll be looking at hosting them as well. So yeah, there is effort, but we have not formalized to that extent.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. As far as the forum is concerned, I think, first of all, it's important we put it into context. We do have foreigners legally registered with CEDAW. Those are the foreigners that were registered legally by our predecessor body, the Security Officers Board, that were regarded as registered in terms of the current CEDAW legislation. That's one. And our current legislative framework still provides for foreigners to apply for registration. We can consider, for instance, if you have permanent resident status in Africa, you meet the requirements and you can be legally registered. But I think the concern is more the illegal foreigners in the security industry, which is the big challenge that we as a regulator face. And I think the most important part of dealing with that is this renewal project that we are currently busy with. because a renewal project, besides the fact that we want to get the old certificate out of circulation and replace it with the new certificate, which got about 15 different security features that can't be copied, part of that renewal of registration is algorithm linking with the Department of Home Affairs population register. So the person that applied, you know, for registration, we verify against the population register of the Department of Home Affairs directly through electronic link to confirm that the person is in fact a South African citizen. That's one part of it. The second part is the monitoring. And I think partly that was the reason why we increased the fines. We asked them to increase the fines from 10,000 Rand to 1 million Rand, because we want to discourage businesses from employing illegal foreigners, but to take due process and due course to ensure that whoever they employ are legally registered with us. And we are seeing a definite increase in the penalties being imposed. A well-known state-owned entity was imposed a fine of 3 million Rand the end of last year. So we are giving increased stick to those that choose to evade the legislation, and we hope to continue to do so.
Thank you very much, David. That's the responses. Any other questions? Thank you very much to the board, the chairperson and the members, as well as the director and the members for this interaction. I think today was also to get feedback, but also I think the director made a point in his introduction, the issue of the trustworthiness of the private security for the committee is very vital, because most South Africans, they have everyday interactions with private security, whether it's at the shop or the bank, or wherever they operate. So it's quite critical that the code of conduct must be adhered to. So we support any measures to ensure that that code of conduct is enforced, that we strict penalties for people who do not comply, and that we deal with the irregular and operators who do not subscribe. So we will support that. We will also monitor the progress of CIRA going forward, and I think we'll meet again in April with regard to the strategic plans. But we thank you for the reaction today. Thank you. Thank you, members. We will then meet Thursday at 10 o'clock. Thank you very much. Meeting is adjourned.